Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, it's me, Richard Herring. I'm in my wife's office because the sunshine from my window in my office was oppressive. I hope you're well. Welcome to another episode of Rahalastapa. What's been going on with you? It's always me talking about myself, and I feel that's... I'd like to hear a little from you. No? I've just found this beside me. This is a copy of the Weird Friends Fan Club, which is written by my wife, Catherine Wilkins. I just read this, I mean, about 6 months after it came out. I'm a terrible husband, but it is brilliant. I'm very impressed with my amazing wife. It's a book really for sort of pre-teenage children. Girls probably will like it more than boys, but I'm a boy and I liked it. And I would recommend it to you as an adult, if you're an adult. If you're a pre-teenage child, don't watch this video, please. It's not for you. But you can go and read my wife's book. If you make a J.K. Rowling, then we can retire and you'll never have to watch this rubbish again. So think about that next time you're on Amazon. Go and buy some of her books. Any road, this is a wonderful podcast with Frank Cottrell Boyce, another fantastic author. He does write brilliant children's books too, as well as being involved with the Olympics and films. And, well, you'll find out all sorts. He's a wonderful, wonderful, lovely man. Do support us. Go to gofasterstripe.com/badges if you would like to give us a tiny amount of money every month to keep these things going. Go to richhang.com/geeks to find out for Rahalastapa is coming near to you. We're in London on Mondays in March and early April. There are tickets left for most of those shows, but they're selling pretty well. Okay, come on. Let's go. Let's watch Rahalastapa and listen to Rahalastapa with Frank Cottrell Boyce. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Liverpool Playhouse. You're already much better than last week's talking. Every last one of them was a fucking cunt. Please welcome a man who is hoping to get into a fight tonight, as he per usual in Liverpool. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Thank you. Hello, Liverpool. It's lovely to be back. Welcome to Richard Herring's Live a Bird Shagging Triathlon podcast. It's got to come up with new ideas for a podcast every time. So what I've got three of the members of the Live a Birds. Polly James, remember, was one of the Live a Birds. Most of you too young for the Nara shoes from the Live a Birds. Molly Sugden is in it as well. Got to try and shag all three of them. And it's now. Not in the party, you've got to shag them now. It's not. I mean, Molly Sugden's been dead for about 25 years. It's not. It's not going to be that nice. If you want, you can have Lucy instead of one of the women. Me too. That nice. Don't remember the Live a Birds. Not the actual Live a Birds, the Live a Birds. Oh, never mind. But I was, what was I going to do here? I was hanging around. I'm there. I was hanging around with the fifth McGann brother the other day. There's five of them. You might only know four of them. There's the fifth one is Ian McGann. If you know him. The McGann brothers were created by a cloning experiment. They started with Paul McGann, and then just every copy that came out just slightly uglier than the last one. It was just slightly, it was like Paul McGann, but just not quite as good looking every time. Ian McGann is so hideous, he's in an attic in the McGann house. He listens to a lot of podcasts. He calls it Rahalastapa. So, love to be here. Of course, the people of Liverpool, I'm sure, are delighted that Boris Johnson is our current PM. I must be very, very glad that as we are at time of recording, this information was correct. He called people of Liverpool mawkish, and then he's still got to be PM. So I've decided to call your fucking cunts, and I hope I'll be president of the world one day. That's how it works. That must be how it works. I was down at the Albert Docks earlier, lovely place to go. Liverpudlians are forced to confront their shameful past by looking at this morning map in there with Fred, the greatest show, Fred Talbot. It's good you still have to confront it. that's about it. Oh, no, I was going to tell you about how I was like 12 years ago. It is now, unbelievably. I did a gig in Liverpool. It was the last gig of I was doing a show called Menage a Un, which was about my attempts to have a threesome, which was unsuccessful up to that point. And I kind of thought if I did a show about it and sort of toured the country and just begged women in the audience to go along with it, you know, eventually, just the law of averages, someone would go along with it, right? Liverpool was the end of the... I deliberately put Liverpool last as a kind of safety net, just in case it hadn't happened. I got chatted up by some girls because I was young then, I'm beautiful. But we ended up... watch the show, Oh Fuck, I'm 40, read the book, How Not to Grow Up. But I ended up in a fight with a university lecturer, so it's the most middle-class fight you've ever... Neither could actually fight, but I've made it an annual thing now that every time I come back, I do. If there are any university lecturers in who think they can take me, do meet me after the show and we'll try and just a little... Any university... Is the guy in the university lecturer? He's 12 years older, I reckon. He was a bit taller than me. I just had to punch him in the balls, really. That was my only option. Didn't work. Didn't work. But anyway, it's lovely to be back in this wonderful city. So, Mike, my guest this week is probably best known for his role as car boot dealer in Framed. I hear he only got the part because he was wanking off the writer. Will you please welcome Frank Cottrell Boyce, ladies and gentlemen. Come in, sit down. Actor, the actor, Frank Cottrell Boyce.
Paul McCartney replacement.
You're the Paul McCartney.
How many phone calls were there between Paul McCartney?
I think you were in before Paul McCartney. I think I got you. And I thought, I better get a name. The truth is, I just signed up to a site that is not worth doing if you book celebrities, by the way, where they give you all the details. It costs like £60 a month to be a member of this. And I just thought, I'll do Paul McCartney for a laugh. And that was the one that got back to me. So when they're fans of the podcast, they say, oh, eventually come down. If you're listening, Paul, you're welcome. I told them
he's welcome anytime, is what I say. If he turned up tonight and I said, bump Frank, he can come to Hull. You'd come across to Hull. I'm struggling for Hull. If anyone knows anyone who lives in Hull, it might be funny, let me know. So you've done a little bit of acting in your own in the films you've how you make appearances in your films your own.
It's
films.
Not deliberate. I've been in two.
Right.
And one was I was in Millions, which is the film that I made with Danny Boyle, and only because God, he might be in tonight. There was a guy, and I was involved in this drug rehab project, and I said to Danny, "This guy will be brilliant, and he needs a break." And he came to the and he was brilliant at the he was amazing at the audition. Never showed up.
Yeah.
And Danny just went, "You're on." So that was my acting career.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. I didn't know the lines. He said, "You wrote them."
Yeah. I didn't bother learning them. Yeah. If you write them, you can make up new ones. That's the beauty of being the writing and acting in your own stuff, which I occasionally do. That's the only roles I get where I'm not playing a perverted postman. But I am ready for if Danny Boyle is in and has a perverted postman in any of his upcoming films, I'm very happy to do it. I mean, it's where to start with you. Again, it's astonishing the amount of stuff you've done. I'm a writer. I like to think that I'm terrible at it. I'm terrible at sitting down and doing it.
I feel as though I should say something at this point.
It's all right. You don't have to. You probably won't ever see it in my stuff, so it's fine. But you are creating stuff all the time. And it's all amazing and impressive and getting made.
Is it?
Well, I think so.
But getting made is like a thing, isn't it? Because like, getting any film made in Britain is an achievement.
It is.
So I did a film a few years ago called The Railway Man with Colin Firth.
Yeah.
And it's a true story. And on, I've got a daughter who, when she was little, she was very ill. And she wanted to go on this school trip, and she was in year six. And I said, "Oh, I'll come with you. I'll put you on the bus on the way back." She needed a parent with her. "I'll put you on the bus on the way back, and then I'll go over to Berwick-on-Tweed to interview this guy." Right? It sticks in my mind. So I put her on the bus, year six. She went back home, and I went, got all these trains across, Berwick-on-Tweed, interviewed this guy, made the film. When we made the film, she had to get a babysitter for her second baby.
It takes a long time, which is why I got into podcasts, really, because it's quite immediate.
The guy, yeah, that's why, yeah.
They
the guy
go out.
Died on the right. last day of shoot.
But what I'm impressed about, I've got two children, and I can't. I'm so tired that I cannot do a single fucking thing when I sit down at my desk. And you've got seven children. Yeah. I mean, I know they're spread out a bit, and they've
grown, they are
spread grown
out.
Up a bit. But how?
They're just nicer than your children.
They must be. How do you cope with seven children, first of all? But how do you then write with seven children? That's just...
Well, I never didn't have them. Do you know what I mean? Like, that was what... When I started...
You were born with them?
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Like, when I started writing, I already had kids, so it was all... I think that's how I got it, because I went for this interview at Brookside, and which had just started, and we just had a baby, and I was, like, desperate to get work. And I managed to leg this interview at Brookside, and I'm sure I got it just because I looked too young, you know, and too hopeful. And they were like, "So, do you want to tell us anything?" "We just had a baby." Like, "Oh God,
give him a job."
Yeah, so I got the job. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. Well, I'm glad that helped. It hasn't worked for me. No.
Yeah.
Actually, I did get a job because I had kids, which was working on Breeders, which is a new sitcom coming out with Tim from The Office is in it, Daisy Haggard's in it. I got sacked for not being good enough, so it's put me off writing. So my kids have ruined that as well. Yeah. I've got to write six episodes of a sitcom in the next month. It's only for the radio, though, right?
No, you'll do it. You'll do it. It'll be great.
Do you write? Are you the kind of writer? Because I don't really like to plan, and I've seen you say you don't like those kind of books of how to write movies. But do you still plan ahead? You don't like the three act kind of.
No, I do like to just jump in. I wouldn't recommend it because I haven't written any hit films. I've been going around going, "This is rubbish, all this verse chorus thing." I've never had a hit. It's like, I am like, the way not to do it, it might be me. Well, you know?
I think it's, but I agree with you because I think you find those writers who do write to those, they know every beat and they know when you've got a hit.
Yeah, you know when you're being manipulated, don't you?
And yeah.
it's just dishonest.
And it's sort of, you can find that a bit naturally, but also it's more surprising if it doesn't.
Well, the thing is that people are paying to go on courses to learn stuff, and you know what shape a story is because you've been brought up on film. Yeah. You know, it's in your DNA. If you can tell a joke, you know about the timing of a story, so you don't need to be taught that, I don't think.
Good.
It's somewhere in you.
It's just this 6 episodes of this sitcom are just going to come out at some point.
Absolutely, yeah.
I hope so. I've been doing it for about 2 months. I've written 2 half-an episodes. I've got all the characters already.
What's it called? It's
called Relativity. It's the 3rd series. The thing is, thanks to some big Radio 4 fans there, the thing is, a lot of it's just stuff my mum and dad have done. Well, my dad really has done. He hasn't done anything funny this year.
My dad's got dementia. And he's an absolute font of hilarity.
That's good. I wish my dad had dementia.
Really recommend
it. But it wouldn't be good for this sitcom because I've already had a character with dementia. I can't go back and do that again.
Yeah,
I
can't get
had
better.
My grandma in it and she died. So that's no use to me, is it? Can't bring her back, can I? Oh, she wasn't dead after all. Do some more funny dementia stuff. It was a very moving thing. But I knew a lot about you. But the thing is, with being a screenwriter as well, is your name doesn't really necessarily get put above.
No,
the title.
That is like a non-existent job. Being a, you know, I think Ben Hecht, who must be like the greatest screenwriter, he said, if you're interested in prestige and fame, you'll get more prestige and fame riding a tricycle. Should I tell you a story about that?
Like, yeah.
Okay. So when I was about... I had a filming competition at the Cannes Film Festival. I think it was like my first... or my second film. I was really young. And the Cannes Film Festival is like... it's serious, you know? And competition... there's only like 12 films in the competition.
Yeah.
And this is how seriously French people take that competition, right? So you have accreditation. And if your film is in competition, you've got a different colour accreditation. I went to Mass on the Sunday morning. The priest was giving out communion. Le corps de Christ, le corps de Christ, le corps de Christ. He got to me and went, le corps de... ooh. He stopped. Thought he was going to give me a second host. You know. Have another one. Go on, go on. Take a big look.
And that's a bloke giving out the body of Jesus and he's impressed.
Yeah.
Fuck, this guy's better. This guy's better than transubstantiation.
And then, like, so when your film is on in the evening, like, only, like, there's a slot where the competition films go on. Everyone knows what time your film's going to be on. And they, I mean, it's amazing. Like, this, they send this fleet of limos to collect you, and you go along the Croisette, and there's all these people with cameras along the Croisette. And the limos crawl past, and people
crouch down
and take pictures. So you can see these flashes going. And they crouch down, it's the writer. Like, oh, fuck it. So you can see this, like, illuminated Mexican wave of contempt go by. And you get out the bottom of the red carpet and they get out and they walk up and people are screaming, you know, the name of Woody Harrelson was in this. They're going, Woody, Woody, Woody. And then you go up and it's like...
But, I mean, well, there's a lot of... I'm looking at the wrong page. There's going to tell you we're in Dinner Ladies next. There's... No, I've gone back. There's so many. So that was Welcome Sarajevo, I presume.
Which is
Hillary and Jackie.
Which I didn't know was you. No.
And there's so many.
We shot that in Liverpool. Hillary and Jackie is a film about the cellist Jacqueline Dupre. And we shot every single scene of it in Liverpool.
Right.
And I went and watched this screening of it in the Philharmonic with my mum. And it's like the first time I've seen it. And she went... because it was all different places in Liverpool, done up to like Moscow and Jerusalem and London and everything. But she was recognising the one. She went, "This isn't the film. This is the 60 bus route."
But you know, you've worked with Michael Winterbottom, 24 Hour, Party People, Cock and Bull Story. Yeah.
That got into the Cannes Film Festival as well. That was an ill-matched thing. That didn't really work. Because we had a press conference and, like, for Tony Wilson, God rest his soul, and I really mean that, he brought, like, this whole entourage of Waifs and Strays with him.
Right.
And Cannes Film Fest is very, very serious, and we had this press conference that should have been Michael, you know, holding his earlobe and talking about existentialism. And it was just this bunch of Fatneck and Tommy and all these people. And someone asked the question, I don't know why I'm telling you this story. Someone asked the question, someone from the Christian Science Monitor asked the question. And I said something very nice about Tony. I said, you know, the Thatcher years were terrible and he held up this beacon of beauty. And God, my daughter's here. I'm going to quote somebody, right? And Rowetta was sitting next to Tony. I said, he held up this beacon of beauty and it was hope for us. And she went, yeah, but he's a twat, though. And he turned on her. And it just turned into this absolute full-on fight. People chucking stuff and everything. And, like, I just remember looking out at these, like, foreign journalists with the things in their ears going, what did he say? What did he say?
And were you thinking, shit, why are you doing this now? I could have put this in the film. Yeah. This could have been the end of the film if you hadn't got the film already.
I'm just thinking, why did they want to watch this film about a TV presenter from the Northwest?
I was mistaken for Tony Wilson. You know, last week, I don't know if you were here, I was mistaken for Brad Pitt by a taxi driver.
Yeah.
I was also mistaken for Tony Wilson, which is more insulting, I would say, given he'd been dead for quite a while and was quite significantly older than me.
So two people I've been mistaken for. I was mistaken for Patrick Kluivert.
Okay. I don't know who that is. Is he a...
He's a Dutch footballer, okay, but he's a black guy. Okay. And I was mistaken because I was walking around Amsterdam, and the kids were playing football, and a ball came to my feet, and I went to pass it back, missed, and it went in the canal, and he went, thanks, Kluivert. And I've also been mistaken for... I was, like, a film that was on that got nominated for BAFTAs, and they do this thing with a brochure, and they get a famous photographer to take loads of portraits. And I was younger and slimmer and better looking, and there was an actor that I used to get mistaken for, which was Alan Cumming.
Oh, yes.
You know Alan Cumming,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
No, don't say, like, little I can
bit,
see that. No, you can't.
A little bit,
right?
Little
okay.
Bit.
So I went, and Rankin, who you look a bit like.
Okay, I'm off the mistake.
Rankin was going to take my photograph, and I went, is this our same? I was on the same day. I must have been doing it alphabetically. So I rang at the door, and Rankin came to the door, and he went, fucking hell, Alan, you look terrible. No, I'm not Alan, I'm Frank. I look bloody brilliant.
Even a good day. we'll probably come back to the films. Let's talk about the Olympics.
Oh, right, okay.
Just because, I mean, has it? You wrote the opening, the whole opening to the 2012 Olympics.
Yeah.
Which everyone knows, right? So everyone knows you for that.
Well, not in my demographic, because my demographic is little kids, so I don't have to talk about this, which is great.
Right, okay. But it was such a hopeful, I mean, an amazing thing to be involved in, obviously.
Yeah, obviously a pack of lies.
Well, it turned out to be.
In retrospect,
If you did it now...
Because that's, like, as wrong as anyone's ever been about anything.
I just wonder whether, like, all the evil people in Britain saw it and went, no, we're not having that.
Yeah. I think that might be true.
We're going to turn this around.
I think it might be true.
Because it was a wonderful, multicultural, inclusive... Beautiful.
Do you know this story about Giles Curran? Giles Curran was in the stadium, but you had to file. And he got there early and he watched all the green fields and thought... And he filed this, what he thought was a very funny piece about it. I think he called it Pomp Rock Teletubbies and said it was shite.
Right.
And then, like, about 15 minutes later, it was like, oh, this is the best night of my life.
Right.
But he'd already filed it.
Okay.
And it went... So it went out in some editions, early editions of the Times and not in later ones, and he had to kind of... He wrote this piece. It was very gracious, actually, about, you know, he was wrong.
Yes. I think it's wrong. I think that was wrong. You know, everyone's entitled to their opinion.
Yeah. No, that isn't true, actually. that is a myth. There's a lot of people who are not entitled to opinion. People who have not looked stuff up about global warming or finance or... Yeah, they're not... No, shut up. We are not sick of experts.
But how do you? I mean, so like that as a writing job. I know you did it with Danny Boyle. How did you go about creating that extravaganza? That's such and the scope of it seems limitless as well.
It was like on a film, the job descriptions are very. you know, blurred anyway, aren't they? Yeah. So it was like I was the writer in the room.
Yeah.
And there was a designer in the room, a brilliant guy, Mark Tilsley, and there was a musician in the room. So I would just, like, pull stuff together. And there were like, lots of writing jobs to do that was, like, you know, putting it in together in a sequence, but just also writing that page of A4 that went to the dance captains to explain what they were trying to do, or writing letters.
You ended up... a lot of it just do some shit in here. I haven't got an idea. Dance around a bit.
Just
you come up with something.
Do it. Do an Olympic.
But was it literally anything you wanted to do? Because the scope of it. I mean, you got the Queen in there. Jumping out of her...
Yeah, I mean, the Queen had to be in it. You know that, don't you? Like, that's the law.
Right.
We had this washing line. Because it was like... I thought where I was really happiest creatively was in year six, in Sister Paul's class. And we did a lot of stuff that you did in year six. We used to do topics where you, like, fill a little scrapbook. So we did quite a lot of that.
Yeah.
And we had this washing line which had the timeline on it. And we put things on... The one person who really genuinely sat down and wrote something was Mark Tilsley, who was the designer. And he came in one day with that whole thing of the Queen parachuting in. That's absolutely nothing to do with me. Okay. He came in with it. And Danny went, "You've nicked that from somewhere. You know, you've forgotten, but it's like it's in Johnny English or something like that. But put it up anyway." And we put it up there, and he was like, "We can't use that." And because someone's put a good idea up, you can't think of another one.
Nice.
I think the only person who got paid in those 2 years was Mark's son, who we gave 50 quid to spend time on YouTube to see if anyone done anything like this. we just couldn't get it. And then about a year, maybe 18 months out, we got a producer, Tracy Seward, who's just this astonishing force of nature. And she said, "What is this?" And Danny went, "Well, that's Mark's idea for how to get the Queen into the stadium, but obviously we can't do that." And she went, "Well, let's see what we can do." This is a long story.
Okay? Yeah, no, good.
Okay. So she fixed up this meeting at the palace and said, "It's so clear." She went, "You don't need to come, honey, because it'll just be really boring, and I'll go. And we'll just, you know, because we don't really want anything from them except permission to find out what she's wearing on the day, permission to have an actress portray her in that way, and also I'll take some snaps and we'll find somewhere that matches the palace." So she went to this meeting, and there were Dutchy original biscuits, and which she texted about, went, "There's Dutchy original biscuits."
She gets those for free. Like,
"The Queen's dresser is a Scouser."
Right.
And she's with the Queen all the time, and we could talk all night about these coats and things, but anyway, she said, "So what we want to know is what the Queen's wearing on the day so we can make a match, and we'd like to match somewhere for the palace." And her dresser went, "Why is that?" And she went, "Well, because we're going to shoot somewhere that matches the palace." And she went, "You have to shoot it here." And she went, "Well, that's very nice, but it doesn't have to be." And she went, "Well, she's not going anywhere else." And Tracy went, "Right, well, no, we didn't mean the Queen to be in it, to be honest. We just wanted..." And she went, "Well, I wouldn't mention that if I were you." Very, very keen. She's very keen. Very, very, very keen. So she put herself up for that. She gegged in. The Queen gegged into our ceremony.
But did she have to audition for the part?
She didn't have to audition. But she looked at this beautiful... what do you call it? Like the drawings that Mark had done. What's it called? When you do all the shots?
Yeah,
the thing.
Thing. You work in films.
Storyboarding.
I've written a few films, so I don't know. Yeah, I write radio sitcoms. Fuck off, mate. We don't have them in those.
She looked at the storyboard and she named the helicopter. She went, "That's a Western Scout. It will never fit under London Bridge. What do you need at the square?" It was incredibly helicopter brand aware.
Yeah.
So, right, I'm going to finish the story. Right, okay. So a few months before so we shot that. That was in the camera. You know, that was the thing that we knew was safe, because everything else could go wrong, but this was film, so it was fine, except for the parachute. The guy could die, but apart from that, he would die outside the stadium, nobody needs to know. And the exec producer rang me up a few months before and went, "Have you seen The Sun newspaper?" And I went, "Well, mate, how can I explain this?" No. Anyway, well, I think you should look at the website. And they had it up. They had photographs. They had the whole story. Everything that was our our ace up our sleeve. The whole thing was right. in the paper. And he went, you need to ring Danny and tell him. I went, no, I don't. You need to ring Danny and tell him. And he went, no, you need to. So well, it's like, I'm going to mass. And came back a couple of hours later and he went, look at the website again. The Sun had run it on April the 1st. And every comment under it was, you must think we're stupid. That's obviously photoshopped and that nobody believed. So the one time in its entire history that the Sun told the truth.
Oh, brilliant. And that shows the rest of the country you can do without this thing. You don't have to have it. No. Terrific. I'll ask you some emergency questions. I'll ask you them. I'm very interested to know if you could have one item from any museum or art gallery in the world. I'm guessing you're going to go local, but let's see. What would you take home with you to keep if you could take one thing and keep it?
The Lewis Chessmen.
Ah, that's my one. You can't have them.
But it's Noggin, isn't it?
Yeah, because you love that Noggin the
Knob. Yeah, yeah. I knew that you'd done that, but yeah. I'll fight you for them.
Okay, well, there's enough. You could have the reds and I can have the whites.
Do you know what I love, though? Do you know that big jar, that big Siberian crab in the front of the Liverpool Museum that's been there since you were a kid? I've always liked that. I'd have that then.
Yeah,
you can have the chessmen.
They are good, those. That guy who found one in his drawer.
The Lewis chessmen. Yeah. Yeah, not a Siberian crab.
Tiger, no.
You'd know it was there.
It was wrapped up in paper. But that guy, that's annoying. That's what I want to happen to me.
Yeah, that was annoying. I have to say.
Why does that always happen to other people who find the Mona Lisa in there? Bedroom.
So you know the Mona Lisa was stolen, don't you? You know this.
Yeah.
It was stolen by Vincenzo Perugia.
Okay.
And do you know what happened after that?
I don't. Go on. You
people queued up to see the space on the wall where the Mona Lisa used to be.
And
isn't that
it
cool?
It was better.
It was.
Then all the art galleries suddenly realised walls were better than paintings, yeah. And the world fell apart. You know a lot because the Framed is about
it starts with that story.
Well, you know, so you, a lot of your film ideas you're taking from at least real life. I mean, some of them are more real life. That one was based on a real story, but
well, it was based on two. Well, based on the real story was that all the paintings from the National Gallery were taken away in the Second World War because Churchill was worried that working class people would steal them. And flogged them, or that the Germans would bomb them. But either way, he was not into it. And so they were hidden in a slate mine in North Wales.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that was a very intriguing
story.
And then the other story that it's based on is like something that I did, which is that there's a castle in Scotland called Drumlanrig, which has a very famous art collection. And nobody goes to Drumlanrig. Drumlanrig Castle is technically open. It belongs to the Duke of Buccleuch. Okay. And it's open like 20 minutes on a Wednesday. You know, for tax reasons, it's open very sort of obscure times. But there's a lady with a clipboard and you can go in. And we were on holiday then. I was talking to someone in a pub saying, you should go because they've got a Leonardo, they've got a Rembrandt, there's nobody there. It's not like going to the Louvre. You don't have to stand behind a red thing. You can walk right up to these things and look at them. So somebody, 2 days later, I swear to God this is true, somebody drove up in a Vauxhall Nova, walked in, said hello to the lady with the clipboard, walked up to the Leonardo, the Madonna of the Yarnwinder, took it off the wall and walked out the front door and drove off. It's the biggest art theft in British history. And he just literally drove off with it in a Vauxhall Nova.
Yeah. And
this is really true. And I feel totally responsible for that.
Right.
Because I think he was in the pub.
Yeah.
And he heard me go that and thought, that's a good idea. And I've told that story before, and that is sort of why I wrote that book. Then they finally tracked it down, and that painting is now in the National Gallery of Scotland. The guy who nicked it, his name was Boyce. And he's from Muggle. How mad is that?
Wow. Was it you?
No, it wasn't me.
Do you clone yourself? It's very popular.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Good. Well, so when you, because when you with Millions, you came up with the idea as a film, right? That was the, and then you turned it into a book after the.
Nobody wants to make family films in Britain because if you make, you know, an art house film, you're up against Giorgio Yiannopoulos or whatever. If you make a family film, you're up against George Lucas.
Yeah.
Or Disney or Pixar or whatever. So nobody wanted to do it. But that script was passed around for years. And everyone would go, that's a brilliant script.
What made you want to... Because you now, I've seen you say you see yourself as a children's author now. What made you want to go from writing those more adult... There were adult films and then you decided to go sort of more family films. It's quite a...
Well, that's just... like that's still kind of the only really family film that I've done.
Right.
Because
but
you can't do it. Well, I'm doing one... I'm working on like a... big DreamWorks film now,
right?
But I'd always wanted to write children's books. I love children's books. I read a lot of children's books. So the story Millions is that, like that. Do you know Delane Lee? Do you know what Delane Lee is? Do you know that place it's on Wardour Street? And all the edit studios are in there.
Oh yes, yeah.
And it's like a rabbit warren of edit studios.
Yeah.
So there'll be someone, you know, editing some tiny obscure thing, and then the next five rooms will be James Bond or whatever. So Danny was in there editing 28 Days Later. And someone had discarded a copy of the script of Millions, and he started to read it in one of those little kitchen things while he's waiting for the kettle to boil. And then he rang me up and he went, this is great, I'll direct this. Why has nobody offered it to me? And he was literally the only director in Britain who it hadn't been offered to because it didn't have any zombies or drug addicts in it. And then we met and he went, this is a completely brilliant script up to page 29. And then after that, shit, but we'll fix it. And so we went out to dinner and we were talking about books. And Danny is this like incredibly voracious reader, but also a very adventurous reader. So he'd be reading stuff about AI or about the political situation in Kazakhstan. And I'd be sitting there going, and Millie Molly Mandy is very underestimated. It's got a kind of minimalist vibe and rural idyll thing. And it's, you know, it's under, you know, and so he just said, why don't you write a children's book? And I went, because I've never had an idea. And he went, two little boys found a bag full of money. And honestly, I'd never thought of it till that point that you could do it as a book.
Yeah.
So I legged it home and did it as a book between him agreeing to shoot it and it getting shot.
Right.
Yeah. That's the fastest I've ever done anything.
As a writer, just that happens sometimes, right? When you just so... It has happened before a long time, but where you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't...
And how treacherous is it?
Yeah.
Because then you think you can do that.
Yeah.
It's like the time that you went to school on the bus and the bus came just as you got to the bus stop and the next bus was there and so you thought, I can do school in 22 minutes. It's like, no. You did it once in 22 minutes. Do you know what I mean? So from then on, I've been like, yeah, I'll do you another book, 3 months. it'll be translated into 40 languages. It'll win the Carnegie Medal. Don't worry. It's like, never happened since.
But I know sometimes just an idea grabs you enough. I've had ones that nothing has happened with, but that I've had to stay up all night, you know, getting down.
Yeah. But the fact is, nothing's happened yet. It's
that's true. I'm getting on. I've been waiting. There's a drawer full of scripts, but fuck.
Yeah. Liverpool's the right place. I was thinking about this because you were talking about this before. And like, Liverpool is like this city of like there are ghost buildings, like the films that you've not made.
Yeah,
it's like because the Catholic cathedral should have been this huge thing by Lutyens, and there was a Will Alsop cloud building that was going to be at the... I can walk around Liverpool thinking, a completely different city in your head of failed projects.
Yeah.
Well, that should have been this.
I'm going to just leave my scripts in the kitchen down in Wardour Street and hope that someone picks them up now I know how it's done.
They've been there a good long time.
I mean, it's sort of interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, you've been writing for a long time and it's obviously through skill and talent, but there's still, even with you, there's those elements of luck.
Oh, yeah, completely. And sometimes maybe it's not luck, maybe it's just waiting. An idea just has to find its moment. Sure. Yeah. And you can just wait for it and suddenly it's like, oh, that's been waiting for this to happen.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be cheerful.
I know, it's terrible.
It's horrible.
What I should get on is a bad writer. That would make me feel better.
Say that again?
If I should get a really bad writer on who isn't doing very well, it would really cheer me up. Go, yeah, well, I've got Radio 4 sitcom. I haven't written it, but, you know, it's on the way. And so your latest children's book is Runaway Robot?
Yeah.
Which I was hoping would be mainly about me and just finally... I wrote the robot escaping, but gaining a consciousness and going, this isn't right. But it's not about that. I had a little look at it. I had the book and I paid for it twice.
Yeah, good.
Because I had the book at home and then I was going to read it on the car journey up and I left it at home.
That sounds disturbing that you're going to read
so,
it on the car journey.
Well,
you weren't driving?
I was going to have a look. No, I was being driven. And so I've got Ben Bailey-Smith read it to me instead. On
oh,
audio.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
Yeah. But it's a nice idea. So the idea is about a boy who's... Yeah,
that's a true story. Well, two stories there. Well, yeah. In the 20s, this guy called Captain Roberts built Britain's first... this is kind of an Olympic opening ceremony story because he was running this big science fair and the Duke of York was supposed to come and open it.
Okay.
And he said, oh, I can't come. And he went, stuff you then. And he built this robot to open the science fair, a replacement Duke of York.
Right.
And it's Britain's first robot. To be honest, it's not really a robot. It's like a... I've forgotten what the word is.
Android?
No, it's
a
not
mechanical
an Android.
Thing. I'm just suddenly just got an image of, you know, the current Duke of York having a robot and that's all. I've just got a terrible scenario has played out in my head, I have to tell you.
Do you want to know something really terrifying?
Yes.
Since the time of Henry VIII, every single person who's been Duke of York has become king.
Wow. Well, it's not going to happen this
thought.
Time. It's not going to happen.
Listen, after the 31st of October, anything. So we built this gigantic robot, which became a kind of huge hit because no one had ever seen anything like it before, and it toured the world, and it could shake hands with you, and it was interviewed in the New York Times, and it was this massive sensation. And then just before the Second World War, it vanished, and everyone's forgotten about it. So I like those little gaps in history. Yeah. What happened to Eric? So I've said that he ended up in left luggage in Speak Airport. I still call it Speak Airport. John Lennon Airport. Okay. And the other thing that happened is that I was a little bit involved with a charity and they were dealing with like truant kids who mostly sag school and then get on a bus and stay on the bus all day. This one kid who used to get himself smartened up and go and sit in departures. I thought, how cool is that? So it's sort of about him.
Right.
Yeah. It's a tribute to someone who could sag with style.
No, it's not, but and also it's lovely to have that kind of a hero of a book who's naughty.
Yeah.
And, you know, and...
And he's got a prosthetic arm as well, of course. I keep forgetting that.
Oh, yeah, it's quite important.
Yeah.
I haven't got through the whole thing. No spoilers.
Okay.
I will. I'll read to my kids in 8 years. I find it difficult to... I love audiobooks.
Yeah.
Because I can digest books on my dog walks and when I've got driving the car around. But I can't read anymore.
Because
of the kids mainly. I'm just so tired. And there's just
read to them.
There's no. Well, I read them. You know, I read Mr. Men to them, but that's not. I mean, it's good, but it's not. And there's still. There was a question I did on House of Games, which I'm on the champion of champions of House of Games.
Hey.
Can't tell you how it went, but a question came back for the Mr. Men, and I couldn't get that right. And I'd just read every single Mr. Men book to my daughter.
What Mr. Men question can you possibly?
Well,
get
it right? It was quite a little because they do a round where they have the kids of the people who work on House of Games write questions, and so some of them are 4 and some of them are 5, and they're quite, you've got to think outside the box, and this is a book who wrote the book is about a man who ate a lot of eggs and said something. And it's Mr. Strong, I think, eats lots of eggs. Although I thought it was my second choice. I nearly got it. But I thought Mr. Greedy. Mr. Greedy does eat a lot of eggs as well.
Yeah, to be fair.
But Mr. Strong eats lots of eggs. Do you like the Mr. Men?
I'm not mad about Mr. Men. No.
Some of it's a bit dated. The Little Miss books are more dated than the Mr. Men.
Yeah.
But some, I mean, they're sort of encouraged, like Mr. Greedy has to become thin, and it's sort of not.
I feel
PC,
it's about a kind of bunch of eccentrics and people with various disorders who are not being tolerated. And being
I think it is.
Held up to ridicule.
But my
you
kids.
You tickle on, Mr. Tickle.
But my kids.
You tickle if you want to.
No, I agree with that. And I felt that. And my wife's very strong and stuff like that. But the kids love them. And
they
my 2-year-old just loves them.
Yeah.
He just says Mr. Men all the time.
Really?
And then doesn't really. You get the book and he doesn't really look at it. But
Mr. Maybe Men, that's Mr. why Mr. your kids are exhausting. That, like.
So, yeah, I was never a big reader. And right. I think maybe to be a good writer, you have to be a big reader, right?
I don't know. I mean, I do read a lot. But I am quite audiobook dependent as well. I don't think so. Actually, no, seriously, some of my key reading experiences weren't me sitting alone with a book. They were listening to Kenneth Williams on Jack and Ori, a teacher reading to you as a treat on a Friday afternoon, and my dad reading to me.
Yeah.
So they were kind of, you know, they were audible experiences. They were shared experiences. It doesn't have to be, you know, alone in a garret with a...
Well, and you want your books to be, your kids' books to be read
to read
by,
them. Yeah.
Read with parents.
Yeah, definitely.
Even though they're for sort of kids who are old enough to read on their own, but it's still
yeah,
nice
but
to...
You know, with my kids, I loved reading to them. We used to fight over who was going to read to them until quite... I mean, and there's loads of kids' books that you don't... that some of the vocabulary is like maybe beyond your kid, but when you read it out, it makes complete sense.
Sure.
So, I would say Just William.
Yeah.
Part of the gag is that he uses long words, and that's really, really funny. Edith Nesbit, who I absolutely adore, but that would be quite hard to read if you were little, but once someone's reading it out to you, it's brilliant. You know?
So. I do remember my dad reading to me, but I also... It's disappointing as a parent, I guess, if the kids don't get it.
Yeah,
my dad always wanted to read Swallows and Amazons to us.
Right.
And we really hated it. And he was like... And now all I remember about it is his sort of... repressed anger he was so wanted to show. He'd obviously loved that book as
a kid.
So
you remember that, but you don't remember that the lead character is called Titty.
if I'd listened, I bet he pronounced it differently. But yeah, it is just to stop that happening. They're fantastic books. We don't need to tell you. Let's talk about, we've mentioned House of Games, let's talk about your own quizzing, which is pretty good as well. I mean, your TV...
Go on.
You were in University Challenge.
Yeah.
And got to the final of University Challenge.
Yeah.
And won University Challenge. You basically got all the questions right and nobody else in your team did. And Reading University you were playing scored 0.
But they were a really good team.
Were they?
Yeah, because they got through to the final, didn't they?
Got to the final and scored 0 in the final.
Yeah,
because
you
destroyed
on
them.
Fire.
How did you do it? You know, is that something
it
you...
just clicked just before the show. I thought, the whole point is that if you buzz in early, buzz in the minute you know you can guess what the question's going to be. Because the questions are quite long and they get easier.
Yeah.
You know, so
but then you have to be quite clever to do that.
Yeah, well...
I mean, that's very much my tactic on House of Games. I buzz in before I've really got any idea. And you've got to do that on House of Games. And they put more pauses in when they put it on the telly so people at home can have a go. Especially when the next lot come out, I want you to know I was buzzing in really fast. As it turns out, a bit too fast. Because I got lots of things wrong.
But you only remember the ones you got wrong, don't you?
Oh, I can't. I'd still, like... All the quiz shows I've done, I still wake up in a cold sweat.
I had no idea that they... Because I wasn't looking at the score. I was just like... And then I did look at the score like about 5 minutes before the end and thought, shit, they've scored 0. And part of me was like, you better give them one.
Yeah.
And then the other part of me was thinking, it's a better story if they don't get any. And then there was a horticultural question on. And what's her name? A horticulturist was on the other team.
Okay.
And I could feel that it was going to be a horticulture question. I was like, boom, I'm in there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Brutal.
And she was broken.
You've got to be.
She's broken.
Is that the only one you've done? Would you like to do? Have you done Pointless?
I did Mastermind.
Did you?
No, I've not done Pointless. Yeah. And I don't know. I keep hinting. I keep going, I can get you. Richard.
I know Richard Osman. I'll get you on. You can come on with me if you're good. Yeah. If you know stuff, you can come on. That'd be a nice
joke. How tall is Richard Osman, by the way?
Yeah. Really tall. I mean, I'm
that
very
is, like,
small.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, we're both quite small. Yeah. He's like you. If you stood on my shoulders now and put a coat on,
seriously,
be a bit shorter than Richard Osman.
Yeah.
You did. So you did Mastermind. How'd you get on Mastermind? Was it proper Mastermind or Celebrity Mastermind? Celebrity Mastermind.
Yeah, it was Celebrity Mastermind. Yeah. And I chose Oliver Postgate as my subject. Yeah. And was kind of enjoying it a bit too much. I got them all correct.
Yeah.
But kind of relished the answers a bit. But I was way ahead on the first round. And then Mark Watson was the other, was who won it. Because he really, like, in the second round, I was so pleased that I'd honoured Oliver Postgate's memory and done a good job of it. And people were kind of, you know, all warm about it. So when the second round, the general knowledge round came up, it was like, you know, who wrote whatever? And I'd be saying, Edward Elgar. Interestingly, he's from where? You know, I was like really chilled. Yeah. And then Mark Watson came on and he was like, just jumping in. Getting.
Yeah, you have to do that. You can't give
anecdotes.
I didn't
know that. So he was like, yes. Yeah. And my mum was sitting behind me as well. Yeah. That was a bit disturbing.
But was she really annoyed with it?
And Ted Robbins was the warm-up guy for that.
Was he? Wow.
Yeah, he came on and sang a few madrigals because it was.
He was the warm-up guy when I did it. I did Rasputin on mine, which was properly hard, not like a children's subject. And I had to learn like all the. I don't speak Russian.
He was Russia's greatest love machine.
He was Russia's greatest love machine. That's it. I just listened to the Bodie M song, and like, other stuff came up. But Ted Robbins said that I had a bit of a beard and stuff, and he said, "You win the award for the person who looks most like their subject." It's quite
that good. That's good.
That's a good one. I got 35 points and didn't win. I'm not going to carry on about it. You listen to the podcast, you know. You know. Right, I'm going to ask you some emergency questions.
Oh, no.
Before we crack on with something else, let's go. Who's the most famous person you've been in a lift with that you didn't get in the lift with?
Can I answer that slightly? Not in a lift.
Okay.
But that film that we're talking about, The Railway Man,
yeah,
with Colin Firth,
yeah,
he said to me, what's the best thing to do? And I said, we should go and meet Eric Lomax, who is the real guy, and he lived in Berwick-on-Tweed. So we got the train up to Berwick-on-Tweed, and Eric was quite frail because it had been 100 years since I started the project. And we'd said we'd be there at like 12:30, say. And we got off the train, it was only like 11:45, so we said, we walk around the town, get a feel to it. And it started to rain, so we ducked into this doorway. And we just stood in this doorway waiting for the rain to stop till it was time to go around to Eric's. And it was Greg's doorway. And this is like about 2 weeks after Colin had won the Oscar for the King's Speech.
Yeah.
And I always think about that day, think there must have been people going over to Berwick-on-Tweed that night going, I saw Colin Firth in Greg's. So,
yeah, that's good.
It's not exactly a lift, but it was.
I sat next to Colin Firth at the Hammersmith Theatre pantomime, I think, something like that.
Right.
But I had to Google who he was. It was sort of like you're sitting next to him, and I had to work out who he was to remember his name to tell my wife who he was.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
I went,
because I couldn't, in the moment of being next to him, I knew enough about him, I just couldn't think of his name.
Yeah, I have had a moment like that because. My daughter, who's here tonight, when she was little, she was quite ill. Oh, I've already told you that. Yeah. And she was in Alderhay Hospital in the build-up, which is children's hospital, in the build-up to Christmas. And in the build-up to Christmas, unless you're very ill, they will send you home.
Okay.
So we were like desperately trying to get her to go home. But as the hospital empties, all these celebrities come and visit the kids who were left there, who were like, don't want to know, you know?
Yeah.
And footballers come and everything like that. And so there's this weird thing of like the hospital's nearly empty, but there are people from Hollyoaks wandering around. So strange. And I went to the loom and came back, and she was sitting up in a bed chatting away to a guy in a suit, a kind of baldy guy in a suit. Because you're kind of waiting for a consultant to discharge you. So I said, oh, hi. And he turned around to me and went, she's bright as a button, isn't she? And I went, yeah, she's amazing. And she's just an incredible kid. And can she come home for Christmas? And he went, well, I don't know. And I went, listen, mate, you know, she's got six brothers and sisters at home. They're really missing. I'm not trying to pin you down, but, like, what's your feel? You know, like... And He went, honestly, I have no idea. And I went, look. And he went, because I'm actually the elderly but surprisingly effective Liverpool midfielder, Gary McAllister.
Come on, Gary, you must have an idea. That's good. But I saw, you know, when you're Googling someone, they're sitting next to you, it's quite, you're worried they're going to see you Google.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, that I didn't is... want to annoy Colin Firth by me not, by not knowing his... You know, you should have known, shouldn't
yeah,
I?
Yeah.
Seemed like...
Seemed yeah, like definitely nice. Stuart.
Seems like a nice guy. So, let's ask... Seems like a nice guy. That's too similar to what we just talked about. Let me... Oh, no, I won't ask you that. Your kids are in. Would you? But do you know? If you,
no.
Have you, no, okay. would you rather have a tit that dispenses talcum powder or a finger that can travel through time?
Quite like talcum powder.
Do you? No, yeah, there's no one ever chooses talcum powder.
I haven't thought about talcum powder for a long time.
No.
No, a finger that can travel through
what
time.
What would you do with your finger that, I mean, in a way, you're a writer. Your finger can travel through time.
Oh, thank you
but,
for saying
what would you do if your actual finger could travel through time?
I would go and nick the Lewis chess pieces from your...
It's a good use. That is exactly...
That'd be some game.
Exactly right. I was going to ask something else then. What was it? Ah, damn, never mind. Never mind, so it'll come up. Have you ever seen a ghost?
My auntie Bretta used to see ghosts a lot because she was one of those women who cleaned ships before they left port. And sometimes if they would clean a ship, they were cleaners and they'd come onto these big liners. And if it was time to go, they would just go.
Yeah.
And these women would be then put on a little lighter and brought back in. Amazing, you know?
Yeah.
So you go down and she lived on Scotty and she would go out. And she every time she seemed to see a ghost and she was completely unfazed by it, she'd go... Oh, I was on, you know, I was on the Empress of Canada there, and there was a lad in a tartan shirt, all shivery, and he'd obviously jam. So I put him on my November pious list. That was it. You know, she'd just go, ah. Oh.
Can't do anything about it now.
Put him on my pious list. Oh, there you go.
So religion's obviously a big part of your life. You've basically married a nun, basically.
Well, she was,
and then gave her made seven children with a nun.
Yeah,
that doesn't sound very religious.
Well, she just bred her own religious order. She's a mother superior. There you go.
There she is.
That was
so. Your wife. You met your wife at university, and she was studying divinity, I suppose.
No, she was. I wasn't.
Yeah, to go to and plan.
Yeah, no, she was going to be a nun. Yeah, yeah. She genuinely.
And you,
was, yeah.
You stole it.
I just
from
thought,
Jesus.
Nah, yeah, forget that.
Jesus
yeah.
is going to be furious with you. Maybe
he's so angry.
A, Protestants are right, and B. Because I don't turn in, because the bread doesn't turn into me. Are you mental? I'd have said, wouldn't I?
It's funny because it's not true.
I'd have made it clear so there wasn't wars and stuff.
Imagine if you get up there and the Amish were right. Did you keep the Ten Commandments? Yeah. Were any zips or fasteners? Well.
You know, I think I went. This might be wrong, but Amish don't like buttons because
no, they're all right. Aren't they all right with buttons? But no, they won't have zips.
No, I think they don't like buttons because it was either because they were really persecuted in Germany.
And that's right. Yeah,
was it because the guys had button? They had
yeah. I think there's a whole button thing.
Or did
going
they cut
on,
the
I know
buttons
that.
Off? I can't remember what it was.
I don't know.
But something with buttons.
I'm having a kind of button moon.
I
mean,
I don't
here.
Think religion's as button based as the Amish. that's where. But, you know, you're an intelligent man and yet you still believe in God. What's
oh,
going
yeah.
on? Let's not take the piss out of like, the Amish with their crazy made-up ideas. What's...
oh, what, you want me to defend that?
I want you to explain why God exists.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you sitting comfortably?
Yeah. I'm open-minded.
Just does, mate.
I'm open-minded.
Just does. It's all there.
I mean, it's a nice idea, isn't it?
It's lovely.
What if you get to heaven and you got it wrong? What are you gonna, how are you going to feel?
See, I haven't lost out there. But
well, you have, because I reckon God would be more cross with you for getting the wrong one than just saying...
Oh, the wrong religion?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's the right.
Oh, yours is right.
There's no question about that. There's never been any question about that. Okay.
That's good. We won't talk about it too much more. I think I'm right. The annoying thing is, if I'm right, then I can't gloat over you.
Yeah.
But if you're right, you'll be pointing downwards.
Yeah, I'll be
if you saw me burning in hell, would you have a laugh?
Worry,
or would you,
you
get me out?
Yeah, I get you out.
Because it doesn't seem very... I think God's... No. If he burns me in hell, that's not very Christian, is it?
No.
Should forgive me, shouldn't he?
He will forgive you.
Oh, yeah. Thank God. Isn't that a problem with Christianity, though? That I could just mess around and then at the end go, sorry.
It's a paradox.
Oh, sorry.
So, like, Tony
Wilson,
his best mate was a priest because nobody lived in the city centre apart from him. And the guy who was the priest in the Hidden Gem, which is, like, you know, he had this beautiful flat in the city centre, but nobody lived in the city centre. So, in this priest were really good pals. And when Tony got ill, he was back in the fold, right? He was a Catholic again. And he rang Canon Clinch and went, I want you to come in. Because they used to eat together a lot, and because there was nobody else around. And he rang Canon Clinch and went, I want you to come to Christie's and see me. And he went, yeah, I was going to come anyway. He went, no, not as a mate. I want you to hear me confession. And Canon Clinch went, fucking hell. We'll have to bring a sleeping bag. That's going to take a while. He said, yeah. 3 days.
Wow.
3 days, he said. And this is what he said at the funeral. He said it took him 3 days during which Tony told me all his sins and frequently forgot to express any regret.
Tony will be all right. Got to let him in. That's
No, you have to let him in.
That's all right. Oh, dear. I'm just so tired. Keep thinking of.
Tony story.
Parkinson doesn't say this, does he? I just had a great thing I was going to say, and then I'm going to edit this bit out to make it look like a genius.
Should I tell you another Tony story?
Yeah, go on.
Okay, so when I started working on that film, my wife isn't from the Northwest, and I had no idea who Tony Wilson was whatsoever. And I've told it anyway. It doesn't matter. Right, she had no idea who Tony Wilson was, and I tried to explain who it was, that he'd been this news presenter, but also this kind of music mogul, and blah blah blah. And in the script, Tony read the script and he hated the script, but he knew that he had to love it, you know, to print the legend. But that had to be something that he could get hold of. And he got me in a corner and he was poking at me. He was going, why have you said that I boast that I went to Cambridge? I've worked with people at Granada for 30 years. Hardly any of them know that I went to Cambridge. I never boast, because in the script he keeps going, by the way, when I was at Cambridge, he goes, I never, ever talk about it, ever, ever, ever. I don't know why you've put that. And it's like, that's the thing he objected to. Not, you know, you pissed away other people's money, you consorted with prostitutes, you're on drugs, you brought gangsters into Manchester. No, fine. But don't say that I bragged about going to Cambridge, because I didn't. So that night, I went home and I was quite shaken. And I put the telly on, and Tony had a late night quiz show, a sports quiz show. So the Donna went, because she'd never seen him, went, Denny, he's on, come and see, this is him, you'll see him, come in. And as she walked in the door, the answer to the question was, Cambridge United. And he went, no, it's Cambridge United. My old university town.
Doctor Who. I've got to talk to you about Doctor Who before. Oh, my goodness. It's been so lovely meeting you and talking to you. You're a fantastic man. But you've also written for Doctor Who. No, but my fans are very into Doctor Who. So we have to talk about writing for Doctor Who.
I wrote the least popular episode of Doctor Who ever.
Which one's the least popular one?
It's called The Forest of the Night.
Yeah, I couldn't picture that one when I looked it up.
Yeah, good.
But the other one...
was brilliant.
Is really good.
About robots. Yeah.
If it's robots, I like it. And it's the one with the robots that want everyone to be happy and then murder everyone who isn't happy.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant. I mean, it's one of the greatest modern Doctor Who episodes, I think.
I just love that thing about AI, I've just read this new James Lovelock. James Lovelock's just written a book, and he's 100 years old. And he's written quite a lot about AI in it and how, you know, we have these kind of ideas about AI, but it's really only an extension of us. You know, it's not something that just does it itself. And it's only one aspect of us, which is this sort of rational, literal, linear thinking. And James Lovelock's the guy who came up with the Gaia hypothesis.
Right.
But he's not a scientist. He's a technologist. He invents stuff. He invented stuff for NASA. He's invented how the lunar module landed. So he's like a problem-solving person and believes really strongly in intuition and ideas that are kind of just at the corner of your mind. So that's exactly how robots don't think.
Yeah.
So I was very interested in kind of the literalism of robots. There's a really great chapter in Runaway Robot where the kid says to him, "Let's catch the bus."
Right, so yeah.
And because it's quite literal,
yeah,
it does catch the bus. It says, "It tried to get away, but I caught it."
Yeah. Do you think robots will be... I mean, I've got lots of questions about robots, but do you think...
I could be talking about robots. We could have just done robots.
We could have just done robots.
It's like almost the same.
But do you think they'll be able to... I mean, that's... So technology's moved on so fast and so quickly that do you not think robots will be able to understand?
I think the problem that we have with robots is that because we are thinking, Eric, you know, we're thinking the 6'2" robot that looks like us, whereas the robots, you are working with robots all the time, soft robots that you don't see. Yeah. Like an algorithm is a robot, really, you know, and all the kind of translation stuff that you use. So it's kind of interesting where it will come in, and we're kind of looking in the wrong place for where... For where artificial intelligence comes in, you know.
Yeah. Do you think they'll take us over and make us their slaves?
Well, Lovelock does, you know. Yeah. Lovelock thinks that there's going to be like they'll keep us as pets because we're helpful. But But I think the thing is that what's kind of worrying about that AI thing is that AI is programmed and designed by a specific group of people, and it is gods make things in their own image.
Yeah.
So like. There is a reason why certain algorithms... Like, so, you know, you must know this stuff about Google having a kind of CV searching thing.
Yeah.
That they had, like, a robot that searched through CVs.
Yeah.
And it was even more sexist and even more racist than they had been because, of course, it was doing it based on what the appointments had been in the past.
Right.
It learns from you.
Yeah.
It just amplifies you. It doesn't come up with a new set of... It doesn't say... Do you know what? Let's build a better world.
No.
It just goes, let's extrapolate from Richard. And,
they'd be and terrible have a kind of
whole Stuart Lee.
That's why they won't put me in charge of the robots.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not just that. look, there was so much more to talk to you about. I haven't even mentioned Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I mean, that is unforgivable. What's absolutely unforgivable. What is coming up for you that you're allowed to talk about?
Well, I'm still like touring around doing Runaway Robot. So if you want to get Runaway Robot, you should get it. It's a brilliant book. And I'm working on DreamWorks are doing a film of the book that I did before that, which is called Sputnik's Guide to Life, which is like a proper big old DreamWorks thing, which is really hard work, but kind of amazing.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing.
Hard work, is it? Well, I'm a massive fan. I was a massive fan of things I didn't even know were you, and now I know they are you. And it's been an absolute honour and pleasure to have you. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive round of applause, Frank Cotter-Boyce. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Frank Cotter-Boyce. Thank you to Pest for providing the music. Thank you to everyone at the lovely Liverpool Playhouse. Thank you to, I don't know, British Comic Guide, Acast, Go Past the Stripe, all those cunts. I am indebted to my producer, James Hingley. I am also indebted to Ben Walker. And my executive producer this week was Hugh Lynn Evans. Not that one. It is that one. He was quite Welsh, but that's not a thing to hold against him. Stop being racist. I despise you. Thank you very much to me, Rich Tang, for producing it and coming up with the idea of doing this. This is a Fuzz, Go Faster, Stripe and Sky Potato production. Why not head to richtang.com/gigs and find out where Rahulastapa is coming next. We're doing lots of shows in London. We're doing some shows in Birmingham and Norwich, and they're sold out or very close to selling out. So buy your tickets quick, my fan friend. Don't leave it too long, my friend.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can. And make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.